You're listening to Fresh from the Hill, Inside Stories of Noteworthy Cornellians. I'm Aaron Camino-Smith, your host, graduate 2004 of Cornell's architecture program. Very excited to be here with my guest today, here with Julio Casado. Julio is the co-founder of Smart Professions, provides talented freelancers skills training and infrastructure support critical to their personal and professional growth. Julio is also the chairman of La Unidad Latina Foundation. They partnered with Cornell to launch an endowment program supporting the Latino Living Center at Cornell. Julio, thank you so much for being here with us.
No, thank you for having me.
We're very excited. Let's jump right into talking about Cornell. When we first say Cornell, what is the word or idea that jumps into your mind?
Ooh, that's a good question. To me, it's friendship. I would say that at Cornell, I made my lifelong friends.
Lifelong friends?
Lifelong friends, 100%. Still am in contact on a daily basis with the guys I went to school there with and with other Cornell alumni that I had a chance to meet throughout the years. And literally, I mean like a daily basis. And, you know, it keeps me connected and it keeps me, just involved in the network.
And now you are class of 2008.
2008.
So it's been 10 years.
10 years.
And still connected.
Still connected.
What was your major at Cornell?
Industrial and labor relations.
Okay. And so how has that led you in the direction you've gone today? What was your time like at Cornell studying?
Studying, probably like everyone else, a lot of, you know, a lot of all-nighters, a lot of cramming, a lot of time in yours, Olin, Catherwood is the ILR library. But, you know, I think to me, the Cornell experience was just much more than obviously the classroom and the academic experience. What brought me into ILR were just an interest in the labor movement. Both my parents are in unions, UFT, and for my mom, and my dad's in 32BJ. And so I really had an interest in studying the impact of the labor movement on American history, on the workforce, on, you know, just the lives of people who come from backgrounds similar to the way I grew up. And throughout my time there, it was really amazing to learn that Cornell has and continues to be kind of at the forefront when it comes to study in that space. And creating professionals who work in that space. And immediately following Cornell, I worked in the human capital space, which is, you know, an extension of labor relations. I was a labor relations rep for a company out in Connecticut, and then I moved into human capital consulting. And though I made like a slight shift in my career when I moved into education, I almost immediately shifted right back. Because education is very much working with people, working in the talent space. It's just the development of people at a younger age. So now I'm back in more so the talent space. It's a cross-section with education. And again, just helping people learn what they need to know in order to have more fulfilling careers.
So making sure people have the knowledge and have the skills and are able to be successful.
Yeah.
We're just as far as being successful, it sounds like Cornell has really helped you be successful in what you've done. But even before that, backing up, did you always want to go to Cornell?
So my junior year in high school, my friend, who I was very, very close friends with at that time, said that he wanted to go to Cornell and he only wanted to go to Cornell. I had no idea what Cornell was. So then, you know, when your friend says, hey, I want to do something, you're like, okay, maybe I want to do it too. We're boys, so we might have similar interests, right? So I went and visited Cornell, and, you know, almost immediately I knew, I was like, this is where I want to go to school. And actually, it took a lot of convincing from people near me to get me to apply to other schools, because I was so sure, and I was so like, this is where I want to go. Why even put in other applications? And people were like, you might not get in. Are you considering that? And I was like, yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Oh, probably not. No way.
Thank God I did. of course, I ended up applying to other schools, but I knew Cornell was where I wanted to go. So I was very fortunate and privileged that I had the chance to do it, to attend.
Were you excited? How excited were you?
Oh, extremely
excited.
Were
they excited?
Super, super. Well, you know, I talk about that with, you know, we work with high school kids now for the foundation. And a lot of kids, again, immigrant kids, Latino background. And my parents at first didn't understand what that meant, right? Because they're not from here, they didn't study here. They may have heard of two colleges in their entire lifetime. Of course, you know, the Harvard, Yale. Not understanding the what it means to go to like a Cornell.
And where are your parents from?
The Dominican Republic. But, you know, it didn't take long for them to kind of mention it at work. And people being like, oh, that's a big deal. And I remember one day my mom came back and was like, why didn't you tell me it was like a huge deal that you got into the school? Uh-huh. And I said, I don't know. I thought I mentioned this. She's like, no, you need to be a lot more excited. People are telling me it's a huge deal. So, like, you know, my family kind of like put it together and figured it out. And yeah, that was the experience getting in.
You're allowed to boast a little. That's fine.
You're right.
We're all friends here. That's what we like to do, and pat each other on the back. Well, it's great that your parents were excited once they understood why they should be so excited about it. So it sounds like at Cornell, being the ILR school, it was pretty focused on what you're now doing. Were there any random classes you took or any other experiences that were unexpectedly fun or even unrelated, but something you really enjoyed?
So the two kind of random experiences from an academic perspective that I remember, I took an architecture class, which...
And I used to be an architect.
There you go. I was not prepared to think in that way. Let me just say, we watched certain... What I remember is watching certain films in that class and having to talk about the way, literally, the architecture and the buildings in the movie affected the mood and the plot and what the message you're receiving from the screen. And again, I never thought in that way. So it was really hard for me to kind of come up to speed with the rest of the class. But by the end, I really appreciated being challenged in that way. So that was really cool. The second, I took a series of classes at the business school, and those were great classes. It helped me connect a lot what I learned in ILR with a very different way of thinking about people in the workforce. You know, for better or for worse, thinking about them as an asset, you know, with a dollar sign attached to them. And that was important for me in my career. And I think it actually helps a lot with what I have to do with what I do now, which is, again, understanding that people, you know, people are the largest cost when it comes to running a business. And the right thing isn't to skimp on that cost. The right thing is to making sure that you're setting up people for as much success as possible, because that's going to produce the most business value. And, you know, it was having kind of like a moment at Cornell my senior year when I was taking classes on both sides that I started thinking about the kind of how that connected and wanted to start thinking about how I can play in that space, being a connection between the two.
So that's interesting, because you had used the word human capital a couple times and you were describing what you did, and you said it was weird to think about people and humans as investments or assets that way.
Yeah.
Is that, have you ever felt weird about that? I guess I'm just trying to add that phrase capital, as I asked a question and then cut myself off asking you another question about it. Do you ever feel odd describing people as capital that way?
No, you know, I don't. Because I think it makes you think about people in a more valuable way. And this applies beyond the business world. So even in the nonprofit world, for example, nonprofits are starting to think about the people that they serve as assets. And because you should be working to maximize the value of your assets. So if your asset is a young kid who may be struggling in school and you're trying to get them on the road to college, right? You're trying to maximize his value. You're trying to make sure that he gets to college. It can sound a little bit maybe cold in a sense, but I think that if we're all speaking the same language and, you know, it's America, it's a society built on capitalism, I think that it would help us reach goals together rather than if, you know, whenever you're speaking two different languages, you're just not working together. Mm-hmm. So I think it's okay to speak the same language if you still have the mindset of what your mission is and what your goals are.
You're not dehumanizing someone. You're just describing them in a different way so that you can, in fact, then help
them. It's a great way to say
their chances.
Yeah.
Well, you're welcome for for that statement. Okay. So it sounds like you had a bit of a zigzag back and forth path then once you graduated. Did you get launched into a one career direction from Cornell? Do you have an idea leaving school which way you were going to go?
Yeah, so my experience with Cornell launched me directly into my career right after, which was the labor relations, human resources world. I had a credit internship at Cornell in Disney World, which was a really great experience. It was actually the first time I ever went to Disney World as an adult. I got free passes to the park, so I visited every single park. I lived in Orlando for like 6 months. Got to meet people, did a lot of traveling because I actually had money in my pocket. That was pretty cool. And even came back to Cornell with a car, which made the second half of junior year a lot of fun. But, you know, that credit internship set me up. I mean, I think I got my first job more because of the experiences I had at the internship than even from what I studied. You know, they came to Cornell to recruit. It was Cornell alumni. So you already had that bond, but you know, what was differentiating me from everyone else is like, I did the work. Like, I know what it means to be in this kind of department, to deal with grievances or to just think about interpreting a collective bargaining agreement. And yeah, it helped me land that first job.
Yeah, it's that real world experience. I feel like you're not boasting enough yet again, but this time about you got to work at Disney. That's amazing.
Yeah, that was pretty dope.
You go to all the parks and ride the rides and then pretend that you're working.
And again, I always feel like the experiences outside of what you're supposed to be doing is what makes something. At Disney, I was working labor relations department. It was awesome. But I got a chance to moonlight as like a worker in the park. And back when they had Pleasure Island, I served as a bouncer for their like disco club. So I got to dress up in this like outrageous like green suit, these crazy shoes. And I was a bouncer. And I mean, I'm not a big guy. You know, if somebody really wanted to get in, they probably could have just moved me out the way. But, you know, it's Disney. It's not about having actual bouncers. It's more about, like, creating the feel of, like, a disco club in New York that you're trying to get into. So yeah. It was tons of fun doing it.
I think you need to find pictures of you in a green suit.
I do need to find pictures of that.
That we can post at some point on the website to show everybody. That's all I can do right now is picture you in a green suit. I hope you wore that back in your car.
Oh,
you went back
God.
Your junior year.
So
after you graduated, it was a couple different jobs, you mm-hmm. said. So what was the first one that you had after graduating?
That was a labor relations role.
Labor relations, okay.
Right, in Connecticut.
And that was in Connecticut. And what was your tasks there? What were your main focus at that job?
Yeah, that was an interesting job. Again, that job was about resolving employee workplace issues. I did a lot of investigation actually into like harassment, workplace violence, sexual harassment. I represented the company at different arbitration hearings. I had the chance to be a part of a couple of collective bargaining agreement negotiations. So yeah, that was a great job. It was a strange job to be in right out of college because the workforce that I was dealing with was significantly older than I am. When I entered the facility, it was a manufacturing facility where they repair jet engines. And so, you know, these are high skilled people. But I came in, you know, and kind of like the immediate word on the street was like, this young guy from Cornell is here. And I think that they were expecting something different. Like they were expecting a very arrogant person who was going to come in and kind of know it all. But, you know, I didn't approach them in that way. You know, I kind of just said, hey, I know I'm new. I'm here to learn. I took the time to get to know everyone. But I was also very strong about my convictions. If I felt something was wrong or something needed to be taken action upon, I did it. And luckily, I had really, really great support from managers, even all the way up to the vice president, who was a Cornell alum as well. He was awesome. He somebody you can always go to and speak to. His name was Rick Waters, actually. Great, great guy. And yeah, it was the best case scenario for me for a first job.
And how long were you there?
I was there, I would say 3 years.
So after that, what happens next? Where do you go?
So I moved into the human capital world. I was consulting for Deloitte. And that was, to this day, I still tell people that was probably the best job I ever had. It was, for that time period, it was a lot of traveling. I actually worked in Texas more than I did in New York, even though I was based out of the New York office. It was a lot of responsibility. Had a chance to, again, connect with a lot of different people, work with a lot of different people. And my responsibilities there were around workforce development. So, you know, from back then and still happening today, technology is impacting the way that we work. So companies are trying to understand how is technology changing the job. It's not always eliminating redundancies or people having to be let go. It's also just changing the way in which they do the job. They might just need to be reskilled or retrained. I helped a helicopter company actually figure out how a systems implementation would impact literally 3,000 of their union jobs. Took me maybe 8 months. Crazy project, but tons and tons of fun. And I had the chance to really learn hands-on, like how people worked and how people interacted with technology when they were working.
So it sounds like you almost had to become an expert in each of these specific fields when you had to go in and help out these companies. Maybe not learn how to fly a helicopter, but at least learn how that business would work, that factory or that something about understanding helicopters at least.
Yeah. Well, what I would say is, because if you ask me right now, I could not go back and tell you what they did on the job. But what I did become an expert in is listening and being able to break things down into sequences, which is actually something that I still do today in almost everything that I do. Being able to say, okay, what came first? That's all I really need to identify. What did you do first? What did you do next? And let's be as specific as possible. And then I can just kind of go back to the manual of the system and say, all right, what's being skipped, what's being replaced, what's being eliminated. So again, I couldn't tell you like the repair mechanic, what he actually did. But I bet you if I went through my notes, I can find out everything he did in exact order over like a course of 8 hours.
Wow. So you, at the time, were an expert in that. That's great.
At that time, yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, what you just said, I mean, that's applicable to everything. Being able to break it down, step one, step two, step three. Did I skip a step? Is there a way to even make step two and three become one?
Yeah.
No, that's excellent. So you were at Deloitte for how long?
I was at Deloitte for 2 years.
So that was 2 years.
I did 2 years at Deloitte. Then I did 2 years more in the talent management space with a financial services company here. And after I put in kind of like that time into HR is when I moved more into the education entrepreneurship world. That's where I actually was elected chairman of LUL Foundation. That was back in 2014. Mm-hmm. And that was a very interesting experience because it was an organization that honestly was kind of on its way out in a sense. You know, it had given away most of its money. The brand hadn't been re-energized in a long time. It was down to the last couple of board members. And I saw something in it, though. Just to kind of make the connection, LUL Foundation is the spinoff organization from LUL, the fraternity, which was actually founded at Cornell. And, you know, I've always believed in the network of the fraternity for more or less because of its connection to Cornell and because I believe in the strength of the Cornell network. So I just saw an opportunity there to re-strengthen it and to help to kind of use it to learn about leadership, to learn about management of people, again, cross generations, learn about fundraising, which was something that I wanted to get into at that time, and also do something good, right? So what we did is we raised money for scholarships. In 2014, we gave out $7,500. The following year, we gave out $15,000. The year after that, $25,000. Last year, $27,500. And this year, we're planning on giving $30,000. So every year, you know, we're increasing the giving. Yeah. We also launched a college access program. So we started with 20 kids. 20 high school kids, helping them prepare for college on monthly kind of intense workshops. We have 140 kids this year, and we're literally at capacity. Like, we can't take another kid even if we wanted to, which is a good problem to have, in my opinion. So we've been working hard. We've been doing a lot of great work. At that time as well, I co-founded a middle school under a charter network here in New York City. And again, just started my entrepreneurship journey where I was looking at how can I pick up projects, how can I expand my horizon, and how can I accelerate my career.
Did you say you co-founded a middle school?
Co-founded a middle school, that's right.
As in like just, hey, I'm going to start a school?
So it was
other people.
Yeah. Well, no, no. It was with under a charter network. So it was under their support and their guidance. Oh, okay. But the principal and I, you know, it was literally, here's a space. The school needs to be built. Like, you need to bring in students. You need to design all the operations, all the systems, from everything from how are they going to enter the building to how they're going to exit at night, and making sure that every kid went home with their parent.
In other words, you had to become an expert on how a middle school worked.
Yeah.
And come up with the steps.
Yeah.
For each part of the day. Yeah.
Every part of the day was broken down, where people were going to be. Again, how are they going to enter and exit the building? Every hour, there was something that needed to be accomplished by both the operations as well as the instructors at the school.
How's the middle school going now?
It's good. I just went to their eighth grade graduation.
Oh.
Yeah.
Did they throw their caps in the air? And
They didn't throw the caps
in the
air. Not yet.
They don't still do that?
No. But it was great.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw them come in. I saw them in the fourth grade, and now they're in the eighth grade, and they've, like, legitimately grown. Like, they're just people now, and I'm like, oh, okay, like, that happened overnight.
They went from kids to people to eventually human capital.
Yeah, there you go.
So now your current, I guess, job, what it sounds like you do everything right now.
Yeah, I know.
Like, you have your hands in everything. What's the thing you do to make money? Let's put it that way. What gives you income?
Yeah, so I, again, do consulting. So, you know, Smart Professions is a way, strictly about making money. Smart Professions is a way I make money. I have another client by the name of the Talent Institute that I'm helping them expand their operations here into the U.S. But what I'm trying to do is create a way for people to quickly learn what they need to learn to do a job that they want to do. Let me be a little bit more specific with Smart Professions, right? Let's say you wanted to do a podcast and be able to know how to record it, edit it, and market it. The best way to know how to do it is by doing, which I'm sure you guys are figuring that out right now. Mm-hmm. And then you have to figure out, like, how did you think about what equipment to get? You know, who did you reach out to? Who did you talk to about that? How did you figure out, like, the programs that you need to use on the computer? How did you think about, or how are you thinking about editing it, mastering it, and then distributing it to people? You know, all of that requires you kind of going out and pulling from the world the knowledge that you need at that time. There aren't really many systems on that built yet. There's a lot built for, like, the tech world. So if you wanted to go become a Python programmer, you can do that like this. You can go to General Assembly, pick up a class, learn what you need to learn, and then probably go out into the workspace. But all of the resources are being focused just in that space. And there's a lot of tech adjacent fields that are not getting the attention that they deserve. And that's, you know, what we're focusing on with Smart Professions. We're talking about audio production, video production, digital marketing. You know, digital marketing, you know, people kind of don't give it the respect, I feel like, sometimes. It's just like, oh, put something on Facebook. What does that really mean?
See what happens. Yeah.
It's a lot of science behind it. You know, doing A-B testing, experimentation, programming around. I mean, Facebook, to become Facebook ad certified is like 40 hours of work. It's ridiculous. Like, you would never think that unless you went in and first knew about it. And then actually went and did it. And you likely can't do it on your own. You need to be able to call someone and say, hey, I know you've done this before. Can you help me? I'm stuck here. Can you, you know, but, and again, this is what we want to try to create for people. If you wanted to pick up and go be a digital marketer tomorrow, you know, we want you to be able to go to Smart Professions and say, hey, this is what I want to be. And we have, okay, this is how you do it. Here's who you can speak to. Oh, and by the way, here are jobs that you can do to start monetizing your skills right away.
Right. So it sounds like it's a really great tool. It's like adult school. It's grown-up school for real people in the workforce. Are you on your own right now with Smart Professions? Do you have some people you work with?
Yeah, so I have a co-founder, and him and I work together. He's actually an audio guru. So he has a lot of the kind of technical know-how. If we ever need to jump in and fix something, he fixes it from a product perspective. And then I'm also working with just other founders of similar companies where we're working together and you know, we do business referrals together and we just help build each other up, and that's leads to more income and also just better branding opportunities as well.
what did it take? Because it sounds like you started this just on your own. So what did it take to decide to leave a job, leave a career, and just start your own company?
You know, it took confidence in myself that I was able to pull on people when I needed to. And it's something that I kind of have proven to myself that I can. So when I kind of launched into this, it was in the fundraising realm. Because I had experience with LUL Foundation doing fundraising. So I was just consulting for different nonprofits, learning about what they're doing and helping them raise more money. And the way I did that was just by going to events, speaking to people, telling them my experiences. And then they would, you know, literally draw up a contract. They'd bring me in and I would help them. It's all about, you know, the network. Honestly, and the Cornell Network, of course, has been extremely helpful. I mean, I can reach out to almost anyone and just say, I need to find someone in this industry, in this part of the world. And, you know, I'll find someone. Just randomly, I learned that someone that graduated maybe 2 years before me was doing very similar work with organizations out in Hong Kong. And, you know, she's a Latina, grew up here in New York City, lives now in Texas, and is working with organizations out in Hong Kong. And she did that because through Cornell, right? The Cornell Network.
Yeah.
It's an advantage that we have. And if I ever wanted to do work in Hong Kong, I could probably figure out a way to work with her, right? So, you know, it's kind of what keeps me going. It's hard. And I've certainly have lost deals. Mm-hmm. I lost a big deal this year, actually 2 months ago. I thought I was going to eat off that deal for the rest of the year. Mm-hmm. And it just got snatched from under me. And luckily, it actually gave me the bandwidth to be able to take on the deal that I have now with the Talent Institute. And that actually looks like it's going to be a more lucrative deal. So thank God. But, you know, it's tough when you're on your own. But again, that's why I think smart professionals are so important, because if you feel like you have people around you that can help you, if you lose a deal one day, you can just kind of lean on the network to get another deal tomorrow.
So you are so even keeled about all of this. I mean, at any point, were you nervous jumping into this? I mean, I used to be an architect and left my job to do stand-up comedy, and it's been frightening and scary, but always something seems to work out. I mean, were you just doing things out of your bedroom and just staring at your laptop late at night?
Well, that's how I started, right? And then I realized that wasn't going to take me anywhere. So I jumped into working out of coffee shops, and that sucked. It's too loud, too much, you know, too many people in and out. All the outlets are being fought for. So I was like, I need to make a change. I went into WeWorks, and I thought it was like the greatest place in the world.
So that's great. So where do you see smart professions going in the next couple of years?
That's a great question. You know, I hope that it just grows into I don't know if there's a model for us yet in terms of growth, you know, because it has this educational component, but we're very much against being a school, mm-hmm. right? Because that already exists in the world, I think serves a specific purpose, and our purpose is very different. What I do know is that we want to at least be in two or three different fields. So we're starting off in audio. We'll likely move into kind of more visual work, AR, VR work, and would like to move into the language field of AI. So AI, there's an up-and-coming field of AI where it's all around language design. So teaching a computer how to speak, not just, you know, your basic common English, but an actual, like, dialects of English, like the way that New Yorkers speak English versus the way people from Philly speak English or someone from Dallas, right? That's hard. And that takes time. And that takes for someone to actually design out a framework of language for a computer programmer. And you don't have to be a computer programmer to do that. You just have to kind of understand programming and understand language. So, you know, for everyone who says don't get an English degree, you should probably still be getting English degrees, because you're going to be making a lot of money really soon as, you know, as AI kind of continues evolving. So just identifying those areas is what we plan to do, and helping people get into it. You know, I would love to help an English major who's feels like they're not maximizing their what they learned at Cornell be able to go and make $150,000 designing language programming for AI.
making a robot sound like a New Yorker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be awesome, right? So, yeah, that's where we want to be.
Wow. Okay. And then, I mean, it sounds like that's you're almost trying to find the thing that no one can see yet. You know, you're looking for something that may appear and then hoping to be that person riding that wave that's about to show up.
Yeah. Because it's coming, right? And I feel like we live in a time of like so much fear. You know, it's driving our political climate. It's driving a lot of the conflict that I think is happening for people because everything is changing so quickly. You know, in our lifetimes, think about how much things have changed. And I think if I didn't grow up in a place like this, I probably would be scared for my life. Like, your phone, you know, cliche, but your phone can do so much more than the computer you had at home when you were young, right? I think that we need to do a better job helping people cope with that fear by giving them hope. And the only way you can give someone hope is by showing them that there are real opportunities on the way, and there are. People aren't going to be thrown out on the streets if we have ways of helping them just shift their skills. You know, we're not talking about complete reskilling or retraining, taking a coal miner and teaching them how to build an AI computer programmer. It's about just shifting that English major into language design for computer programs, right? I think that's what we need to do more of. And I really like being in this space because, again, it gives people hope and it makes them feel like I didn't waste 8 years, you know, studying English at Cornell and then getting the master's or maybe getting the PhD. It wasn't a big waste, right? You never want people to feel that way about something that they dedicated so much time to at some point.
What do you think, only because you are bringing up Cornell and all that studying and that time, what was one of the best things you learned when you were there? Most helpful for what you're doing now?
I think just being active. You know, Cornell puts a big emphasis on being part of student groups and organizations and taking leadership positions. To me, that was really important. You know, I never would have stepped up or even believed that I could step up to be a chairman of a foundation if that wasn't just part of my normal way of being, you know, and it wasn't part of my normal way of being before Cornell, right? I kind of felt like I had to be given permission to do things because, you know, you're a kid, you're growing up with your parents, right? You have to ask them for permission to do everything. Yeah. Can I even be in this after school program? Can I do this? Can I do that? And so Cornell, you know, that freedom, which I loved, you know, it's very much a part of the real world was there. It's actually one of the reasons also why we're doing the endowment fund, because that freedom has serious consequences. You know, one of the things I feel about Cornell is that there aren't, like, you can go down the wrong path all 4 years and there's nothing that's going to stop you. Not because the tools aren't available. There might be some safety nets, but it's easy to not be part of a community. Just as it is easy to be part of a community. You know, you can be by yourself. You can kind of get lost and that can become overwhelming. So, you know, to me, the Latino Living Center is not just because I'm Latino. It's because we need more centers around themes that people can identify with, whether it be your ethnicity, your race, something that you study, your religion, anything. It's just to bring people together to do things together. Because that's the only way for you to make the most out of your Cornell experience.
Realize things in common and then develop those friendships.
Yeah, like develop those friendships, develop and just be in a space where you're working together and the projects just happen, right? Like, I'm sure there was random things. I mean, I've gotten into the most ridiculous conversations that were like halfway intellectual, halfway like, why are we talking about this, right? But yeah. Those conversations they mean everything to when you're 18, 19, 20 years old and forming friendships, right? Because that's what sticks out. And if you're by yourself in your dorm room, and you know, that happened to me. First semester freshman year is hard. I spent a lot of time by myself in my dorm room. And
what? Just because you felt like you weren't connecting with other people or you felt different? Or what do you mean?
No, it was just so many people to connect with. And you know, I grew up here. I went to a large high school, but it was like, where did I want to go?
Here in New York City,
yeah. It was like, where did I want to go? Who did I want to be? Did I want to be with this group of people? It was about just making that choice. It wasn't even about identifying within myself who I already was, you know? So it was hard. It was overwhelming. Thinking about which dining room am I going to eat at and who am I going to sit with? I mean, those things seem trivial now as an adult, but when you're 18, it's kind of like, I feel like I'm choosing the rest of my life right now. Like, this is very overwhelming. And I don't, that's the only thing I'm saying. I don't think Cornell does a good job just helping guide people softly into places where they might feel comfortable in.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I remember for me, that first week or so, 2 weeks of freshman year was when everyone was overly friendly. I remember everyone was, hey, where are you from? Can I sit at this table? And people would just sit down and start talking to you. And it was kind of nice, especially because I was an architect, which was a very specific major with people who spent all their time together. And my roommates were totally different. I was then in the Whistling Shrimp, the improv group, which is also another very specific group. But there was something nice about being able to just sit down at a table and just start talking to someone. But that kind of dried up after the first week or two, which I'm sure is common at any university. That's going to happen anywhere. But you do need to go out of your comfort zone a little and just try it out. Just talk to people. And then either find that commonality, like what you were saying, or because you're different, you have something interesting to talk about.
Exactly.
Yeah. But that's true, because there's Cornell's a lot of options. So many different
options.
Yeah. What was your, just because now that we're talking about Cornell, did you go to the Cornell Dairy Bar?
You know, I think I went to the Cornell Dairy Bar actually as an alumni for the very first time, not when I was an undergrad. I didn't go that part of campus too much. There weren't a lot of classes or reasons to go down there.
I figured, I just wanted to ask to see if you had a favorite flavor or anything there, anything special, and to give you some really specific Cornell question.
Go for it. Not that I can remember in terms of the dairy bar. I'm trying to think favorite things about Cornell. I mean, I remember the places where I would eat at all the time.
So what about food with Cornell?
Food at Cornell is amazing.
The dining halls, and then the view you would have from the dining hall.
Right.
So where can we find information about everything you said? First, let's start with Smart Professions. Where can we find your information?
Yeah, so Smart Professions, go to smartprofessions.com. And if you're interested actually in the conversation around what the new jobs of the future are going to be, we have a podcast as well. It's called Accelerating Future. It's hosted by John Lin of the Studio Project. And we just bring in people of industry who are speaking about their industry and how it's changing. So, you know, the language thing I learned because of that podcast, because our guest, Dennis Morrison, the founder of X.AI, brilliant system that it's like your own executive assistant. Like, you email someone, hey, I want to set up a meeting, and they handle the entire conversation, and you never know you're speaking or you're emailing a computer program.
Wow.
It's unbelievable. But he was the one who was speaking about, you know, you just don't think about the language, how to respond to things. So that was really cool. That's, a way to learn about how the future of work is changing. LULF.org. You can keep up on what we're doing from the scholarship perspective on the College Access Program, as well as more information about donating to the Latino Living Center. We're very close to filling the endowment. It was a $100,000 endowment. I think we're about 85% of the way there. So really what we need are those last minute donations and pledges to get us over the hump. And what I keep telling everyone is that this is just the beginning. You know, I want the Latino community to be part of the changes that are happening on campus when it comes to building new buildings and new just centers. You know, LLC, I love the place, but it's a little run down, right? We need some support. We need a little bit of help. I would love to see that center be, you know, placed in one of the newer buildings and just have a little bit more modern feel and cutting edge technology associated with it. So that's, you know, that's why we're doing this. We're investing in the center, and we're hoping that Cornell sees that investment, sees that we care, and kind of brings us along with their changes that they're doing on campus as well.
Great. So plenty of places online to check you out.
Absolutely.
And if you would like to follow the Young Alumni Programs, check out their website for upcoming events and information on how to stay involved. That's alumni.cornell.edu/youngalumni. Also, stay connected on Facebook with them. You can also follow me if you'd like by checking out my website. It's funnyaaron.com.
with all my stand-up comedy, dates and stuff on there. And my podcast is But I Also. It's a podcast exploring not only what you do for a living, but also what else you love to do. I put on my extra special WVBR radio voice when I do that, because I did spend 6 months as a DJ on WVBR, Real Rock Radio. It's 93.5, 105.5 on the East Hill. And that was one of my fun times, being on the radio from 2 to 6 a.m. while at Cornell. Thank you guys so much for listening. Check out our next episode. Thank you. And thank you, Julio, for being with us.
No, thank you for having me.
Music for Fresh from the Hill was written, produced, and recorded by Kia Albertson Rogers, class of 2014. You can contact him at koa3@cornell.edu.